We are extremely fortunate tonight in having one of our own girls from our General Service office in New York to share this weekend with us and to be our principal speaker tonight. She has been involved in work for Alcoholics Anonymous since the beginning of her association with AA. She has been in charge of our public information service and General Service office for about 4 years. And when I hear the word involved, I'm reminding of the story of old Farmer Brown. He was a very kind and generous and thoughtful soul. And all the barnyard animals and fowls loved him. He would greet them in the morning when he fed them and called them by name. And he had a personal interest in each and every one of them. And all these barnyard animals were sitting around under the shade tree one morning discussing the relationship with Farmer Brown. What a dear old soul he was. And they wanted to do something for him. So the hen said, well, let's prepare him a breakfast of ham and eggs, and we'll take it to him and feed him in bed. About that time, the old pig jumped up and said, wait just a couple of 50 minutes just for him. Says, you're only getting involved in this project, but I'm being committed. But I think that's the way every one of us should feel about our sobriety and our relationship into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. We not only should become involved, but if we want to stay sober and to be reasonably comfortable and happy, we are going to have to get involved. It is indeed a pleasure to welcome and to introduce Juanita N. from GSO.
Hi, everybody. It's wonderful to be here in Georgia, my first trip down here since I'm sober. I don't think I've been down this far. I've never been in Macon before. But it's really wonderful to see all of you, and I'm told that I have no need to be nervous up here tonight because all of my friends sitting around here are nervous for me. And so I have no need to be nervous. I was talking to our co-founder, Bill, on the phone last Tuesday, and I told him I was coming down here, and he said, tell all those drunks down the south I said hello. And, of course, I bring wonderful messages of love from the staff members, all the gals on the staff. And I'm so happy that Joe's staying up here with me. I don't know what happened to the other men. They ran. Now, if there were gals up here, they wouldn't do that to me, would they? Where are you, Speedy? My name is Juanita New, and I am a recovering alcoholic. I have the disease of alcoholism. How, when, or why is immaterial. But it was not with deliberate intention. I did not set out to become an alcoholic. So I have no need nor right to feel ashamed. It was not always this way. I come from West Virginia, and I always associated, well, liquor, or we called it whiskey at the time. I didn't know there were so many kinds. With paydays and Saturday nights, I lived in mining towns. We called them mining towns or mining patches, coal mining. And on payday night or Saturday night, it seemed as if you could hear people who were drunk all over these mining patches arguing and sometimes fighting. And I always associated this with liquor. Sometimes my father was among those fighting and drinking. And I never understood my father. He could go for 2 years sometimes without a drink. And then he'd meet up with a bottle. And it seemed that he had no control after that. I didn't understand this. When I was a child, one time I asked him if he couldn't say no when the bottle was passed around. And of course, later on, I understood why he couldn't say no. My mother used to say when we were sitting around, the gals were sitting around swapping stories, that she could tell stories with the best of them because she had lived with two drunks and certainly had been associated with many others in West Virginia. And she told about the time she sent my father for a pound of coffee, and he was perfectly sober when he left the house. And he came back 6 months later. So all the gals would say, well, did he bring the coffee? I wanted to be in show business. I was a singer from the time I was a kid, and I came to New York and went into show business. I worked in nightclubs when it was the fashion to mix. This meant that when I was in the club between shows, if anyone wanted me to sit at their table, well, that was as much a part of my job as singing was. And I hated alcohol because of my father's drinking. So I asked the gals what they did not to drink. I don't know whether I had some instinct about it or what it was, but I just didn't want to drink. So they told me to see the bartender. And he told me he could give me an orange blossom, and this would be mostly orange juice with a little gin on top, just a couple of drops. So if anyone picked up my drink, why, they would know that I think I had a drink at least. Or he could give me a shot of whiskey with a Coca-Cola, and I could spit it back into the Coca-Cola. All that free liquor that went down the drain, I felt very sorry about that when I was looking for $2.38 to buy a pint, believe me. But I did this for a long time. I was doing very well in show business. It seems that I was very much, before I drank, I was very much like an alcoholic. I was always striving for the top and thinking of pulling myself out of the environment of the mining town. I had a thing about this, I'm sure. While I was working nightclubs, I studied voice and went to Detroit to make a picture for Henry Ford. This was a commercial picture that was shown to all of the dealers. And while I was there, it rained. It rained a lot, and all of our shots were outside. So I sat in the Dearborn Inn, and I collected money. More money than I had or had ever seen, I do believe. And my mother had since divorced my father. So when I got back to New York, I looked at all of this money, and I thought, well, this is a time. If I'm going to sing, I want to be an opera singer. I didn't know any Italian, but I knew that that's where you went, and I did have a teacher who encouraged this. So I called my mother in West Virginia and said, we're going to Italy. Well, I was always a strange gal, she thought, and loved me very dearly, but I was strange. And she didn't know I was quite this crazy, though. She couldn't see why we were going to Italy. But she came to New York, and we went to Italy. And I worked very hard. Now, where I lived in Italy, my teacher, I lived with her most of the time, and she would always encourage me to have some wine. But I didn't want wine. I made all sorts of excuses. I still didn't like liquor. Well, I came back 2 years later just for a little vacation. I had made an audition for the fascist government because everyone who worked in Italy had to be sort of passed by the fascist government. And when I got back home, I was going back in the fall, and I was going to make my debut in Alessandria, Italy, in La Bohème. When I got back home, of course, I was sitting there with my $1,000 in tourist lira in the President Hotel. And I was leaving on September the 2nd, and Hitler marched into Poland on September the 1st. Therefore, I didn't get back to Italy. So I converted my money and studied, and, of course, never got the break here that I might have had there. And I went back into nightclubs. I'd been living in my suitcase for a long time, it seemed to me. My mother spent a lot of time in West Virginia with my grandparents, and I worked. I met a new musical arranger, and I noticed that he wasn't very interested in eating. He was a little man. He would come to the nightclub and play cards with the boys and drink, and maybe a sandwich or, you know, a dish of soup or something. That was all he wanted. But I never considered that he drank too much. You see, I knew about drunks, and I didn't know about alcoholics at that time. But I thought we had everything in common, so, and I had lived in my suitcase too long, and it would be wonderful to be married. So I was engaged for one whole year. During the summer that I was engaged, I worked with the Hammond Morton Circus, and this is a shrine circus, and it has been all through the South. I just was saying I'd never been to Atlanta. Now I remember I was there with the circus. I sang the Star Spangled Banner and a few other little songs during this thing, but during the war, the Star Spangled Banner was added to all forms of entertainment. The band leader told me about the gal who had the job that I had previously. And this gal, he told me, carried a bottle with her to her dressing room, and she took a great big drink before she went on to sing. And I said, well, I certainly want to meet that gal someday, because I couldn't understand why anyone would have to have a drink to be able to perform in any manner. Before I forget to tell you, I'd like to say that 4 years later, I made the same tour with the Hammond Morton Circus. I carried my bottle, and one night I was standing in the wings, ready to go on, and I remembered that I had not taken a drink. So I ran back to my dressing room and got a big drink of whiskey, and when I got back to the wings to go on, I had missed half of the Star Spangled Banner. So you see, I had found out what was the matter with that girl, and I had the same disease. Although I didn't know that it was a disease at the time. I got married on December the 7th, and on December the 25th, I knew I made a mistake. My husband was in show business, as I told you, and he was working with a star on radio. Now, I had given this a whole year's thought and had not seen him, well, too drunk. I had probably seen him drunk, but he was a quiet drunk at the time. On Sunday, we had this gal star at our home for dinner, and I still was not drinking very much. I hadn't completely let down because I was still in show business, and it seemed to me that I didn't want to drink while I was in show business. They drank a great deal, and they went to do a midnight show. Instead of letting her go home, like he should have, he brought her back for more drinking, and they began to dig up old arguments. And they were practically to the point of blows. And I sat back in the corner in my chair and thought, my God, I've married a man who drinks too much and argues. It just sounded to me like the mining towns in West Virginia. But, of course, that evening when she left, why, she was going to fire him, and he said, you can't get along without me. And I was sitting back there thinking, I can change this man, because I'm a very strong character. So I'll have to do something about this. She did fire him, and I went on working, but I don't want you to think that I'm talking about my husband. He never made this program, didn't even try, and he's dead now. But he wouldn't work unless he got the biggest salary, his salary. And I was just the other way. I would work if my salary were $100 and a quarter a week, I'd work for $35. In fact, I had done it many times just to keep working. But he worked differently. So one night I was seen by USO and asked to go overseas. And I was a little bit disgusted with this whole business by now because I hadn't been able to change his ideas from just working at anything to keep going and not drinking too much. By the way, I had joined the before-dinner drink by this time, too. So I might have been a little worried about this. But I came home that Sunday night, and I remember it very well. I said, I have been asked to go overseas, and if you would like to go with me, why, get out the accordion and practice up. And if you don't want to go with me, I think I'll go anyway. I'll go alone. So he went with me. And this is where I started to drink a little bit. I imagine that I felt at this time that, well, I'm not going to be an opera singer. I don't have to always sacrifice for this voice. I'm just going to sing blues and popular music, so it doesn't matter. And it seemed as if we had more fun and were more relaxed when I drank too. Many funny things happened, but we took a whole case, two cases of whiskey down at Camp Patrick Henry, and they told us that we couldn't take it on the boat, so we drank it. We met at the officers' club and drank this whiskey every night, so I was getting a very good indoctrination there. When we got on the boat, of course, we went over with some Air Force men, and they all had bottles and bottles of the stuff, but they weren't giving any away, so I began to find out that I was missing liquor. When we got into Italy, I, of course, gave all of my chocolates, and you see, I spoke Italian, and the rest of them were out, the rest of the show were out trying to learn. They went to Berlitz School, they wanted to learn something because we were going to be there a long time. And I would save all my soap and my chocolate and all of the rations I could get, and always made good Italian friends. And they usually had a bartender in the enlisted men's club and the officers' club that was Italian. So all these dear friends of mine, Italian friends, had to return as a gift was cognac. Now, they drank cognac a lot over there in their little clubs, and it tasted like 80-octane gasoline. That's what we called it. But I never mixed it with grapefruit juice or anything like that. I always drank it straight. And the fellows would call me cast iron stomach. But you know, this stuff fooled me. It didn't give me too much of a hangover. It just gave me a desire for more of it. And it was during this time that for, not with a hangover, I just wanted a drink of that stuff in the morning. So as my husband would go to get me some coffee and bring it back, I'd have a couple of swigs of this cognac. I was not even 1 year in social drinking until I knew there was something wrong with me. And how I began to notice this, we had 1 day off a week when we were in Italy. The whole show had 1 day off. Now, the night before, we would be at some club and we'd dance and sort of relax because the next day was a day off and drink. I drank a little too much. And someone would say, just anybody, any of the fellows would say, why don't we have a show come over to my base? We don't have a show over there. I don't understand why we don't get USO. And I would say, oh, you don't, eh? Well, tomorrow we'll come over and entertain for you. There was a reason they didn't have a show, but I always committed our troupe to this, any base around there where we weren't supposed to be. The reason they didn't have a show was because they were in a security area. And I would not remember promising this, but either my husband or some of the others of the troop would tell me about it the next day. I committed 8 people to go and do shows on their days off. They did not always, all of them, go with me, but I can thank God today that I always went, even if I had to go with an accordion. But you see what was happening, I was forgetting to remember. And this was, of course, the blackout, which I knew nothing about. I thought I knew I was drinking too much, and I knew I had a problem. We came back to the States and prepared another show to go to the Pacific. Now, when I got in the Pacific, the first couple of weeks, I didn't see anything but a little beer here and there, and I didn't care much for beer. And I knew then that definitely I had some kind of a problem with alcohol because this wasn't going to be a very good war over there if I didn't get something to drink. I soon found out where the liquor was, and they were selling it very cheap. We were stuck on Guam for 58 days when we were returning, and I drank a lot. We had very few shows to do. Somebody on Guam handed me a book. I have no idea who gave it to me, how I got it. All I know is that while waiting for orders to go home, I read a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thought it was beautiful. Really, I did. Beautiful story, it read like a novel, And here was a place for me someday. I kept right on drinking, of course, and came back home. Now I was drinking too much. My husband used to say, well, you're not used to housework. When you come to the cellarette, you can stop and have a drink. And you know, gals, I thought I was the only one that did this. I was amazed to find that you knew all the tricks when I got here. I wondered how this happened, these little symptoms of our illness. I would stop and have a drink, and later on, I would have too much to drink out of this decanter on top of the cellarette, and I'd see that this was going to be noticed. You see, I was hiding my drinking from another alcoholic. He drank differently. He drank outside the house a great deal, and of course inside, but I drank mostly at home. So I'd buy a pint, and I would fill up this little decanter of liquor until there would be maybe one drink out of it. And of course, I'd put the half a pint or whatever it was away until the next day, and I would be sitting with one drink when my husband came home from downtown. And then I got a little worried that perhaps he'd find the half a pint I hid away. So I drank that, threw the bottle out, and would be passed out on the couch when he came home. So you see, I was stopping at the cellarette quite often. I thought there had to be a change in my life. Now, I accused my husband of everything in my own mind. Perhaps I never did to him, because I, as you might know by now, I was not one to argue. I thought that he was driving all of my friends away from me. I was very interested in little opera, old little operettas that went on, little amateur things before I got married, and I had lovely friends, women friends, and they would come to the house. And as I began to drink a great deal, they made little mention here and there of that. Now, of course, my husband would go out of the house when they came. I thought, of course, he was driving my friends away from me, but what man wants to sit around with four or five women during the evening talking? But the fact would be that I had a great deal of liquor before they came. And one night, which was really the straw that broke the camel's back, my dearest friend said, did you have a lot to drink before we got here? And of course, that was what drove me away from my friends. We had no longer had anything in common. They didn't drink the way I did, and of course, I didn't want to have any more to do with little opera things, because you can't do that when you're drinking. I must give full time, or as much of full time as I can, to my drinking. And, of course, something has to change. Occasionally, you have to try something. That's another thing I found out when I came here, that I wasn't the only one who changed jobs or got a job because I might not drink so much. I got a job in an office. I had been trained for office work, and I liked it fully as well as show business. I got out of show business, I must say, little by little, and I believe that I accused my husband of helping me do this, but it was really after a couple of agents had noticed that I drank, had carried something to drink, perhaps, or had too much to drink. I guess I didn't want to be found out, so I sort of slipped out of show business. You know, I love this office work. I love this job. I started as a file girl for $35 a week, and I wasn't going to drink. But I knew where I was going to go. I didn't know how it was going to be arranged, but I went back to school and studied shorthand again, and I was going to be the boss's secretary. There was where my eye was, and I went very fast to that position. I worked for about 6 months, 5 or 6 months, without drinking anything at all. And one night, one of the gals had a birthday. I had 5 martinis, and I went home and went to bed and felt like $1 million the next morning. Insidious, isn't it? I really felt wonderful. And, of course, as you have said to yourself, things will be different this time, you know. I must have it licked. Deep down in my heart, I knew I didn't. I knew I was a drunk. I called myself a drunk. Well, after I started drinking, the weekends would go something like this. Or if I had 3 days off, I always cleaned my house, because you're not going to find me drunk with a dirty house. And then I started drinking. And sometimes there would be a day when I couldn't get out of bed. And life is too short to not know you're here for one day, ever so often. I knew it then, and I used to beat my hand on the bed and say, God, why did this happen to me? But I can tell you one thing, I understood my father much better at this time. Well, I liked my job, and I didn't like what was going on at home. But I was offered a job that paid more money. And if it was anything we needed at home, it was more money. My husband worked off and on, not all the time. So I changed jobs, and I hated that job. I was unhappy at home, and I was unhappy at work. I was drinking a lot, but I was just on the verge, I suppose, of a nervous breakdown. I don't know whether it was all drinking or just unhappiness. But I would wake up in the middle of the night and be crying. And even sometimes when I was not drinking. So I couldn't stand it, I guess, any longer. And I left New York. My husband didn't know I was leaving for good, but he might have known, because I still had that character that says you don't run out of a job with no notice, that you try to be a little responsible. I went to Detroit, where my mother was working in a restaurant. It took me 10 days to settle down, enough to go look for a job. And I got a job immediately. And I weighed 175 pounds. And through the accountant, woman accountant I was working with, I found a good doctor, and I started to lose weight, and I didn't drink for 8 months. My mother retired, and we got a little apartment. And, of course, we had nice friends, nice new friends. And I went from 175 to 135, and everything was lovely. I didn't have a husband to worry about. I didn't have any bills piling up on the bar. I was covering everything. And why couldn't I start drinking again? Just socially, of course. Deep down in my heart, I knew I couldn't do it. But I was going to give it another try. I used to, after being on the wagon, and I would take a bottle home for no reason at all, only that I wanted it, I'd pour it over the rocks. I'd long since learned that's the easiest way to drink it, because I'd get shaky before I took the first drink. Just watching it made me shaky. And I would talk to this. I would be alone. My mother went home quite often. She's the oldest girl. I would talk to this drink, and I'd say, I know what you're going to do to me. Maybe I won't get drunk tonight. Maybe not this week. But eventually, I'm going to have one of those days that I don't know I'm in this world. And I would talk a long time, and then I would take the drink, and then I argued no longer. Because after that, I had no argument left. So the obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body was very simple for me to accept. I'd done it by talking to my drink. I had two drunks in Detroit. The first one, my mother was home, and I had 5 days off. So I cleaned the house again, did the washing and the ironing. And you know, I don't know what I did for the next 4 days. I know that I drank for a couple of days, that I went out to a hotel for lunch with a woman I knew very slightly. And I believe she had a problem, too, because her husband, when I visited in their home, made sure that he made her drink and gave her very little liquor. And we drank quite heavily that day. All I know is that I couldn't get to the hotel dining room unless I took a cab from home down and another cab back. I couldn't make it. So I was in fine shape. The last day before I went back to work, I tried to sober up. The last night, let's say. I didn't go to bed. I lay on the couch in the living room, and I didn't have a drink. Worst thing I could have done. The next morning, I was making a payroll for 99 men who were working in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I was in Detroit, Michigan. They called in the time. They were electricians. The fellow in charge called in the time at 9 o'clock. These 99 checks had to be figured up and in the mail by noon. Well, this morning, I knew I was in bad shape, but I still had enough liquor to be able to start and do it. And I got the checks all out. Everything was fine. Nothing wrong with the figures. But in the afternoon, you see, I had no chance to get a drink at all in this office. And in the afternoon, as I started figuring up the union and so forth, I took that payroll out a week later or before the accountant got a hold of it and looked at it, and the writing was straight up and down, just like this. No writing at all. I knew what should be there, but I couldn't write it. But so I was afraid to get up out of the chair and leave before anyone else did. I had a key to the place, and I waited till everyone went home. And I got up. You see, I was afraid if I got up, I'd fall flat on my face. And my knees were shaking, my legs were shaking. Now, I walked out the door and locked the door. And next to this office on Grand River, which was practically demolished, by the way, in the riots, next to the office was a half a lot with bushes and things like that, you know, real country, just a half a lot. And as I got to that place, I looked down, and there was a green snake about this long, wobbling all over the... And I think Margaret told me that I thought I was on the verge of DTs, but I'm sure that now that she's explained the difference between DTs and hallucinations, I was having hallucinations. And I ran, I took off like a shot and ran down the corner of the block and turned and looked back, and it was still there. So I grabbed the cab and went home. I didn't usually do that because it was quite a distance from the office, and I was alone, as I told you. And I hadn't paid my bills, and I was worried I had some things to do for the office that had to be written out, and I couldn't write. So I had to run home, and I vomited. Oh, I was so sick, just from seeing the snake, of course, and the liquor. I took out a bottle and just had enough to steady my hand so I could write some checks and do a few things. But this was the time that I was going to quit. And about 5 days later or so, I went to dinner and somebody sat a drink in front of me. Well, I went to the ladies' room. When I came back, there was a dry Manhattan sitting at my plate. And I said, oh, I wasn't going to have a drink. And this fellow said, well, fine, I'll drink it. I said, oh, no. You see, I didn't know how to say no. There's one great thing. Today, I have a choice. And I never have to say yes to another drink. This makes me feel wonderful. But I did not know how to say no once it was placed in front of me. And I'm not sure whether I could have turned it down had it been just offered. But I was going to try that night. Well, I changed jobs again and was working for Philco Distributors. And we worked about 3 or 4 months and they sold the distributorship. I was working for the general manager. Now, I had been sober again, or just sort of social drinking, let's say, because I could do that. And when they told us they were going to close the place, they were going to sell the distributorship, all of the rules were let down in the office. All the gals went out and drank their lunch, of course. Now, the other gals came to work and felt fine the next day, or so it seemed to me. And I wondered what they had that I didn't have. I've since learned it was what I had that they didn't have. I had the disease of alcoholism, and they didn't. So they could keep right on drinking. But after a week of this kind of drinking, my mother was home again. I woke up on Saturday morning knowing that the only reason I could get out of bed would be to get a drink. So I drank that weekend, and when Monday came around, I called the office, and you know, I was a little tired of this. I didn't stay away from work very often. I'd go to work shaking and sick, but in Clarets, well, Clarets, you know, they don't do a thing. You just, and the vomit turns green, let's say. I'm sure some of you have had that experience. But I told a real whopper this time. I said that I had been to a dentist and I had been given too much gas, so I was sick and had to stay home. My mother was due back on Thursday. And on Tuesday, about noon, I had no drink. You see, what I was trying to do, I knew she was coming back Thursday, and I also knew that I was staying away from work. This was bad, because here I am going into a week that I'm not sure I'm going to be able to go to work. And as I say, I hadn't stayed away from work too much. I always managed to get there. Not always, but I was never away many days in succession. And I was trying to pull out of this drunk. And a key went in the door. I was in bed with a cigarette, but no drink. And a key went in the door, and we lived in a little apartment. You walked in the door, and there was a bathroom, and over here was a little living room, and then a kitchen, a little kitchen, hardly big enough for two. And over on this side of the door was the bedroom. And you could see all over the apartment. So when the key went in the door, I got up out of bed, left my cigarette on the ashtray, and ran into a little closet that held about three coats. And my mother came in and said, "Babe, where are you?" And I said, "I'm in the closet." She said, "What are you doing in there?" And I said, "Well, I thought it was the manager or the lady manager, you know, and I didn't want to see and talk to her." And she said, "But she would have seen your cigarette, and she would know you're here." So my mother didn't say much more, but about an hour later, I went back to bed. I told her the same story about getting too much gas, and I went back to bed, and an hour later she was going to the store. I hadn't done much of that, you know, and she leaned over to kiss me goodbye, and she said, "Now I know what's the matter with you." And she just as well have taken a wet towel and slapped me in the face, because I gave up. You see, we'd never been able to talk about it. She had said at times, "You're doing something I don't like." You see, starting to drink after I had been on the wagon for so long. I guess she thought that was for good. And she would say, "You're going to get so you can't do without that stuff, or it's going to kill you." Well, little did she know I couldn't do without it then. I wonder why if we can put ourselves in someone else's place. I tried with her. One night, I came home, and I was not drinking. One of those times I was not drinking. My mother didn't feel well. And she was on the couch, and I said, "Why don't you have a drink?" Of course, that was a cure-all for everything, you know. And even though I was very generous, even though I wasn't going to have any, I thought she should. And just in fun, I only had about that much in the bottle. Just in fun, she said, "If I had enough of that stuff, I'd get drunk." And I said, of course, very pleasantly, "Well, I'll go out and get some." She said, "No, I was only kidding you." And that night, looking at TV, or she was looking at TV, I sat in a chair and I thought, what would I do if I came home and my mother was drunk on the couch every night, like she finds me most weekends, and has to sit here, and what would I do? And do you know, I couldn't quit drinking. I couldn't put myself in her place and quit drinking for that reason. But I did think about it. Well, anyway, my mother knew her drunk pretty well, and that week she gave me a little bit of beer every so often. And she knew I didn't like it anyway, but not too well, but I would take it. It was alcohol. So Friday I had to go to work, I felt, because I needed the check. The boss was very lovely, and he said, "I would have brought the check over to you. You look very sick." And I was very sick, believe me. But he didn't know from what. When I got home that night... Well, before I tell you that, let me give you the power of public information. Believe me, it's been one of the hardest, most difficult jobs I've had at GSO. because it does require a complete change of thinking. I feel it's the most difficult. But the power of public information is tremendous. Every Sunday in Detroit, we had a TV program, a closed meeting on TV. Mr. Hope, it was called, the Mr. Hope Show. And Mr. Hope was a great big fat man, very nicely dressed, and he sat down at this edge of a coffee table, and then there was a couch, and there was always one woman pouring coffee, and I thought, oh dear, how can she do that? You know, I would have it down somebody's neck. And then another man, and then one sitting at the edge of down at the edge of the coffee table. And Mr. Hope conducted a closed meeting, 1 o'clock every Sunday. And we looked at this every Sunday, only the Sundays I was drinking. I tried to keep my mother away from that television set. I didn't want her to identify for me. It seems she had, because that night we were in the kitchen. Her shoulder was to my shoulder. And it was a little small kitchen, and I kept the liquor under the sink. And I said, Mom, let's have a drink before dinner. She'd have one drink with me. Let's have a drink before dinner, and this will be my last. Now, whatever made me say that, I don't know. And my mother said, who is this man, Mr. Hope, and where is his organization? I think I'll send you down there. And that's all the push I needed. I said, you don't have to send me. I know who he is and where it is, and I'll go myself. That's all it was said. We had our drink. I ate, and I slept well. 3 years later, we were talking about that weekend and what I had done that weekend. I couldn't believe it. I went shopping, and I don't like to go shopping after I've been sober 10 years now. I hate to go shopping, for dresses especially. And my mother remembered everything we had done, and I said, well, I couldn't have. How could I after being so sick? She said, I don't know, but you weren't sick on Saturday. You were all right. And I realized that I feel that that must have been, my surrender must have been the beginning of my spiritual experience, because I didn't have a hangover after I made a decision to come to you. Well, sometime in the afternoon after we got home from shopping on Saturday, you see, this is my love story in AA. I love to hear everyone tell about how they came to AA. To me, it is the beautiful love story. This afternoon, my mother said, aren't you going to call someone? She had not mentioned anything. And I said, oh, yes, yes, I am now. You know, I've made a decision. Don't rush me. And I finally made the call. And I gave myself away beautifully, because I said, where do you have a meeting tomorrow? And that would be Sunday, and the answering service, whoever answered the phone, I don't remember now, said, well, we have lots of meetings tonight. I said, oh, no, you don't have any meetings on Saturday night. You told me you didn't. And my mother's sitting there. I had called AA, and I hadn't remembered too much about it, but I knew that I'd called, and that they'd always told me about a Sunday meeting. And the reason I knew, I kept that Sunday meeting in mind, is because it was a public building, and it was only about 2 blocks from where I saw the green snake, you see. So I knew where that was. But at least I told my mother there, accidentally, that I had called AA. But when the time came, I didn't have my nails done. I remembered why I didn't go. There was always something. And perhaps I didn't remember. Maybe I was drinking too much. But I had called, so I'd made the first gesture. But I needed my mother's little push, you know. So, all right, they told me 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. And that night, I got in the shower, and, you know, I felt crawly dirty. Yeah, I really felt dirty. Not the bottoms of my feet all over, Margaret. And I got in the shower, and I was in there about an hour, and my mother said, babe, what are you doing in there? And I said, I'm brainwashing myself. You know, I'll never have another drink as long as I live. So, and I feel crawly dirty, so I have to get clean. Now, I was much too emotional to go in and face my mother and talk to her. Pardon me. But I talked to her through the door. Now, I had the door open, of course, and I'd talk in the bathroom, and she could hear me out in the little living room. And I said, Mom, Now, I know something about this AA. You see, I'd read the book the second time, I forgot to tell you, but you'd all changed it. It wasn't the same book. I'd progressed a little bit, and I wasn't thinking quite as well by this time. But I knew there was AA there. But I said to Mom, well, now, I know about AA. You know, if I go there, they always go out and call on people, and they go to meetings, and they're very busy. And I said, I won't be here. And there was a dead silence for a little bit. And then she said, Babe, do you think you have been here? And then she said, if you will only quit drinking. She said, you know, I've wanted to kill myself. If I believed in it, I would have. I would rather have died than to sit here and watch you drink and see what you were doing to yourself. But she said, if you'll quit drinking, I would eat bread and water for the rest of my life, and I would wear an old calico dress as we used to wear them if I could find one. And I said, oh, you don't have to worry about that. We'll have lots of money when I quit drinking, you know. Well, the next day, we looked at Mr. Hope, 1 o'clock. The meeting was 3. And all she did was say, aren't you going someplace this afternoon? And I said, oh, yes, yes, I'm going. Would you like to go with me? And she said, of course. And then I thought better about that. I thought she didn't take my hand and lead me down this little aisle, and I will take her later, but I won't take her to the first meeting. And so I got ready, and by the time I got outside, I couldn't wait for a bus. You know, they go slow on Sunday. Now I was anxious, and I got a cab, and I couldn't afford it, but I did anyway, and I went to the GAR building. Now my love story begins. I got to the door. Well, we'll put our door over there. That's where it was. And looked over on this side, and half of the building, it was about like this, or a little bigger, I think. Half of the chairs over on this side were filled with men. And nobody jumped up and said, welcome to AA. I thought, sure, you'd know I was new, you know. Although I hadn't had a drink since Friday, and I was all dressed up fit to kill to come to my first meeting, or whatever it was. I wasn't sure what it was going to be. But I looked and I thought, well, should I go in or should I go back? But I knew myself. I knew that if I got this far and I backed out, I may never come back again. So I started my last mile, and when I got around the corner, I saw a woman. Great day, a woman way down by the coffee urn. And I got halfway around this building, and I turned and looked at the men. They were all from Skid Row, and they were slumped over their chairs. They were slobbering. Some were asleep. Some were drinking coffee, but they were all Skid Row people. And I said to myself, it went through my mind, is this AA? My God, what have I got myself into? And then my God answered, take away the dress, give you a couple of bottles, put you in a room where people won't know, you hope, and how long can you support what you call your habit? You who will pick up your skirt and walk around a drunken woman on a street and at the same time have a couple of fists of whiskey in your arm in a bag going home to drink it. How long until you're out on the street, and if you lose a job, you might be, and you'll be, you know, better than any of these men. And this gave me the courage. This, of course, happened instantaneously, but I thought it was a long time. This gave me the courage to go around to Mary. And, of course, she didn't say, welcome, or you're new. She said, don't I know you? I was dying for somebody to just say, welcome to AA, or something like this. But anyway, at the GAR building, well, we weren't much interested in this until I told her I was new. And she said, that's wonderful. You're going to hear one of the most marvelous speakers today. She said, Jack Love. Jack says, I can use his name anytime, or his family, or his bank account, or anything he has. And I sat all alone. This was all empty over here. We had our men over here, and I sat right down like that. And Jack talked. And when he'd be a little bit funny, I'd laugh. And then he'd be serious and I'd cry. So I sat there and I laughed and I cried all during the meeting. And the men, of course, were watching me. They used to tell me when I was chairman down there for Kingdom Come, you know, if anybody got chairman, why, they loved very much to have you stay because nobody else wanted the job. So every Sunday I was down there for about 5 months. But they'd say, well, Juanita, we will never forget the day you came in. You gave us the best show we ever had. But Jack said, you know, everything that Jack said, I identified with either for myself or my husband, my ex-husband. So it was a story that seemed so as if we'd lived it. Jack drove me home that day, and he said something that, well, really was tremendous, a tremendous thing. He said, welcome home. And you know, that's the way I felt in AA, always home. And there are no more wonderful people in the world. I could really tell you about letters that are received at GSO that proves this every day. And I look at them and say, aren't they wonderful people? Just for any little thing you want done, they'll do it. They're marvelous. I was thinking about that afternoon when I was on my 10th anniversary, June 30th, and I asked myself the question, if Jack had said to me that day, this is your AA, you come here and you sit in this chair every Sunday afternoon for 2 hours, what would you have done? And I would have done that. I would have gone there. If that is what I had to do, I would have done it because I was so happy that I had finally gotten here. And, of course, I went to other meetings, and they didn't tell me I had to sit there. But I loved that group, and I loved those men. I always did, and I always will. And I see them when I go, maybe not the same ones, you know, but I see my boys down at GAR when I go back to Detroit. It seems that AA, when I got into my group, was just exactly what I needed. What was I looking for? You see, I said I will never take another drink as long as I live. And I think the biggest boost was that you only have to do it for 24 hours. And I thought this applied only to drinking. And in the beginning, I would say to, you know, the older members, well, I'm never going to have another drink, so I don't have to ask for this help in the morning. But I will because you say I should. And I was as a child. Everything they said I should do, I tried to do. And as I tried, I accomplished. But as things opened up, I realized that every morning I can either have a good day or a bad day. It's just up to me. And this was the biggest thing. This was what I was looking for when I was running scared as a drinker, running to this church and that church. And I always believed in God. I was trying to find something in religion that would make me quit drinking. Well, of course, I didn't ask for the right thing, you know. I was asking for God to make a social drinker out of me, I imagine, or anything but quit drinking. I didn't know anything about this. So your 24 hours was wonderful, and I, as Joe said, I went into the intergroup office in Detroit. I found business. I found that there is a little business in AA, that trusted servants are marvelous, too, that we have. And ended up at GSO, which was a miracle in itself. Nobody there knew me at all. They knew my application. And people say, how did you ever get a job in GSO? You must have known everybody there. I didn't. I didn't know anyone. I sent in a piece of paper. And then I didn't get the job the first time. The next time there was an opening, they called me in for an interview. But that's how all of our trusted servants are chosen, I believe. One of the greatest rewards of working at GSO is being able to come out and meet you. It's just wonderful because it makes me realize that AAs are the same everywhere. They're wonderful people, and there's a great, great deal of love here. My prayer for you today and for me, well, I'll just say this is my prayer for me. Ever keep me mindful of what I am, of what I was, and of what I may become again if I do not follow this way of life. Thank you.
thank you, Juanita. We're very grateful to you for coming and sharing your experience, strength, and hope with us, and giving us a chance to know you better and to love you more. You please express our gratitude to the General Service Office for sharing you with us. You tell them how much we appreciate the work they are doing, how much we need their help, and how much we love them all. Please carry that message back. Juanita spoke of love. I believe that we are among the most fortunate group of people in the world today. You may have heard it said that the world is going to hell on a bobsled. Now, this may be true. If it is, and if there is a group of people who has a chance of reaching out and grabbing, slowing it down maybe, and stopping it, and telling them the greatest story ever told, the story of brotherly love, of concern, the story that was told exactly 2,000 years ago in the same manner by a man named Jesus Christ. We are lucky. This story is the most powerful thing in the world. Carry the message often and carry it wisely. We are self-supporting in Alcoholics Anonymous through our own voluntary contributions. Our Georgia State AA Assembly and this meeting is dependent upon these contributions, as our fellowship refuses outside financial support. So the ladies will pass some baskets among you tonight, and please give freely so that our meetings can continue and can continue to be a success. Thank you. Thank you. Any more announcements? Again, let me thank you for coming and sharing this and making it a wonderful meeting. Let us all stand now and be dismissed by praying together our Lord's Prayer. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, and thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Thank you.